Great. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Full Potential Parenting Show, bringing information and inspiration to parents of challenging children. I'm Allison Morris, founder and host, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to learn more about how to create a real connection with your child. We all want this, of course, but it can be so hard to unlearn how we were parented, especially when we see how our friends and our neighbors parent their kids, and how most schools assume the worst about our kids' behavior and then punish them to, and I put this in quotes, help them make better choices. So I just want to congratulate you for taking the time to explore some different ways of learning how to develop a real relationship with your child. I am really excited to have as my guest today Bonnie Harris of Connected Parenting. Bonnie has been working with parents all over the world for 25 years, helping them transform their understanding of and their interaction with their children. She's the author of When Your Kids Push Your Buttons and What You Can Do About It, and another book, Confident Parents, Remarkable Kids. Excuse me. And I just a small confession here. I had heard of these books many years ago. And I confess I did not pick them up until fairly recently because I wasn't sure that they would be relevant for parents with challenging children. I thought, okay, this approach might work well for neurotypical kids, but this approach doesn't have anything to offer us, right? Parents of kids with different diagnoses and learning difficulties and stuff. And I was so wrong. I think I read the Buttons book about a year or so ago, and more recently read Confident Parents, Remarkable Kids. And they are so, so helpful for every parent, no matter what your child's temperament or diagnosis. So I was really thrilled when Bonnie agreed to come on the show to help us understand some really profound truths about children. That I think if we can fully embrace them, incorporate them into our belief systems, can lead to a real paradigm shift in our parenting and lead to deeper connections with our children. So welcome to the Full Potential Parenting Show, Bonnie.
Thank you, Allison. It's great to be here.
So, and I should just pause and say folks on the phone can raise their hand by pressing star 2. And if you are on the web, there is a way to just write in a question on the box, so that'll help if you'd like to. And I've already gotten a couple questions in, so I'm aware of those. So thank you. Wow, we have so much to talk about today, and only an hour. So I want to dive right in by asking you about really one of the fundamental themes of your work, which is that all children want to do well. Boy, the first time I think I heard that concept enunciated, it really struck me. And I guess I was shocked by how surprised I was by the concept. Because I think we, as a society, somehow have come to assume that our children, the opposite, really. We talk
it's
a lot
kind
about
of
children.
The Lord of the Flies theory. Right?
Yeah, that our children are manipulative, they're devious, they're out to get us, they are put here to undermine our authority. All these sorts of really unflattering and really unproductive ways of thinking about our children. And we probably don't consciously think that that's how we view our interactions with our children and when they're expressing themselves in various ways. But I wonder if you could just maybe help us understand how you came to that conclusion and where this sort of, where does this come from?
Well, let me say first off that I had my second child. We were in power struggles every morning. And when I wrote When Your Kids Push Your Buttons, I was able to look back on our power struggles that ended when she was five, when I really started understanding all of this, even though at the time I was teaching parent education, had a master's degree in early childhood development, but at home, every morning, I saw that little face come through the door, and I thought, she's out to get me. And it's, and you said it in your list of some of the assumptions that we make about children in general. We think that when they're being resistant, that they are doing all those things. They're being manipulative. They're being, they're trying to get us. They're out to get us. They're doing this on purpose. They're bound and determined to ruin our day. And in the whole buttons theory, those are the assumptions that we make that then lead to the feelings that we have, which are not pretty ones when we think that way. You know, we're furious, we're guilty, we're resentful, we're angry, we're enraged. Those feelings then lead to our behaviors. It's not that our child is making us react this way. It's that our thoughts are making us react this way. So that's what the whole buttons approach is about, and I mean, in a very quick nutshell. And so we do the work on reframing those assumptions, getting more realistic and clear. And so when I wrote Confident Parents, Remarkable Kids, the subtitle is Eight Principles for Raising Kids You'll Love to Live With. Those eight principles I see as the really the way we need to see our children, the fundamental shift in thinking, in switching from they're out to get us to they want to be successful, and their behavior is telling us how they're trying to be successful. And if we can understand that process and that way of thinking, we can have a much, much, much easier time as parents. But I think that, you know, we have been parenting in the reward and punishment method of parenting since time immemorial. I don't know when it was ever any different. So when we see a child's behavior, we either like it or we don't like it. If we like it, we reward it. If we don't like it, we punish it. And we only see it at face value. So we're taking this behavior and we're determining how our child is. We're determining whether our child is good or bad. And, you know, I think we do this because this is the way we were brought up. It's the way our parents were brought up. It's the way our grandparents were brought up. Back and back. So when I say to parents, all children want to do well, all children, no matter what, want to be successful, you know, they kind of nod their heads and think, yeah, okay. And then when we take it to a little deeper level and say, okay, so how can you put that principle into practice when your child is screaming at you, when your child is hitting his sibling, when your child is refusing to do his homework or go to bed, when your child is refusing to get dressed, on and on and on? How do you put that principle into work?
Or how do you even hold it in your head?
How do you even hold
yeah.
it in head
or your heart.
Immediately,
yeah.
Right. Immediately we snap back to, he can't do that. I can't allow that. And
or how dare he, blah, blah,
how
blah.
How dare he, exactly.
Yeah.
How dare he talk to me like that? And
we get threatened. It undermines our authority. It makes us feel like bad parents, we have no control over our children.
Yep.
And then
totally
we catastrophize
powerless.
About the future, right? Oh, he's going to
yep.
be a juvenile delinquent. He'll never amount to anything. We
never
just go to
friends.
Town, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We just, you know, fly into the future in an instant. And that does us no good in the moment. So when we react to behavior that we don't like, in that button pushing way, in that kind of anger, we at the very best are ineffective, and at the worst can be really damaging to our children's self-esteem, their identity, their sense of confidence in themselves. So if I can look at my child, who might be behaving in an unacceptable way, and say, all right, he really, really wants to be successful. So what is this behavior trying to tell me? When we understand this principle, what we see is that when my child is not being successful, when he's not doing well, it's not because he doesn't want to, it's because he can't. And when I see it as he can't, then what I see is that there are obstacles in his way to his goal of doing well, of being successful.
And that's huge, of course, right? Because that's, that gets back to what the thing I alluded to earlier, right, where we talk about, well, they just should make different choices as though they had an option.
As though it really were
a matter of decision making for their child, whether or not to yell or to do this or to not do that. When in fact, then we ironically don't see that our own reactions, we can't control them either.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So we are incapable of it ourselves, yet we expect our children to be able to pull it off.
I often say to parents, have you ever said or done anything that you didn't mean? Always elicits a lot of laughter because, of course, we all
right.
say and do things we don't mean. But we don't give our children that option. We don't give them the room to make those kind of mistakes. If they say something they don't mean, we take it at face value and we use it as evidence that they're being bad and wrong, and we have got to stop it.
There's a sort of a point there, I think, too, that the other thing that I think comes up for us, right, is that we don't like to acknowledge that they want something different from what we want in the moment.
Right, right.
And that we... that's just inconvenient as anything.
Exactly.
They don't want to go to bed. We
Right.
want them to go to bed, and we
Right.
don't know what to do with the fact that they don't want what we want.
Yes, and I talk about agendas a lot in my work, how a child has a certain agenda and a parent has another agenda, and often they are not alike. But in terms of setting our expectations appropriately, setting our head in a different gear, it's important to realize that my child's agenda is just as important to my child as mine is to me. That doesn't mean I have to give up my agenda and say, fine, I won't go to work, I'll stay home and play with you, or fine, you don't ever have to go to bed, just stay up all night. Doesn't mean that at all. It means when I know, and when you think of yourself as an adult, when you know that someone, you know that another adult has an agenda that's important to them, and so when you ask for a favor or you ask to have them help you with something, you speak to them with tremendous consideration of their agendas. But we don't do that with our children. We assume, first of all, when I talk about this, a lot of parents have confessed to me that they never even never even thought about their child having an agenda, much less give it consideration.
Because they're too young, they're too immature, whatever, that they couldn't possibly.
And it's right.
Right.
It's right. I mean, if their agenda is that they don't want to go to bed, they want to stay up, then that's just wrong. They can't have that. They can't do that. They can't. And of course they can't do that. But when I can approach the situation by thinking, well, of course he wants to stay up. Of course he doesn't want to go to bed. Of course he wants to be with us or continue playing or do whatever he's doing. That's an of course, what I call the of course mantra. If you can put that in your head in front of this behavior that needs to change, really. I mean, I need to get him to bed, obviously. But if I think, of course he wants to stay up, that's going to keep me in a calmer head than when I think, how dare he not listen to me and do what I'm saying? So we come at it from a much calmer approach. But I'm feeling like we've digressed off the main point, which I think we need to say a little more
to come
about.
Back to. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, so these obstacles. So when, first of all, we have to understand that a child's being successful is sometimes different from our wants, right? We have to understand their stages of development, and we have to understand their innate inborn temperament, which informs very often how they do things. So, for instance, a child who is particularly slow, has a very slow-moving temperament, who we will then make assumptions about dawdling in the morning and being resistant and digging in their heels, when in fact they just really need to move slowly. We are then making assumptions that they're doing something wrong when in fact they're following their own temperament, right?
Right. They're just.
And we need to understand that and make accommodations for it. Otherwise, we're going to get into tremendous resistance and defensive behavior from our children who are only trying to protect themselves. If I know that my child wants to be successful, that he really wants. And I want to say this, too, to emphasize this point. All of your children want nothing more in life than to please you. And that's really hard to grab a hold of, too, when we see this behavior that is showing us what we think is just the opposite.
Right, when it seems completely calculated to do the exact opposite.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So the calculation, the manipulation, the resistance, the defiance, all of that is stemming from an obstacle. And those obstacles are what are provoking that behavior. So those obstacles are coming from places in that internal emotional state where the obstacle could be anything from somebody at school called me a name today and I am just in a really angry, upset place. So anything that anybody says to me, I'm going to react to. My mother might have not ever know the faintest idea that anybody called me a name in school today. Two, that it can range from that to the cumulative effect of feeling unaccepted, powerless, ignored, not listened to, being treated unfairly. And remember, these are the perceptions of our children.
Yeah, and I would add to that list, especially for a lot of a lot of the kids in this particular community that they have serious issues about feeling unsafe in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They're worried about being abandoned. And there may be other issues as well. So those, and of course then too, their developmental stages might be quite a bit younger than their chronological age,
exactly.
Which can be really confusing for parents as well.
And they're most of them are very aware how different they are. And that difference is going to be exacerbated by an angry parent who is being reactive to them.
Right, and just makes them feel worthless, unaccepted, bad, and they tend to also internalize it and think that everything bad that happens is their own fault and that they caused it all. And of course, our language exacerbates that too, right? We say things like, "You make me so angry,"
exactly.
Or don't make me have to do X to you,
right.
Or some things
Why
like that.
Why do I have to yell 10 times before you listen to me? What we're doing with that kind of language is blaming our children and asking them, telling them that they are responsible for our emotions and our behavior. "You make me so mad" is saying you're responsible for my feelings.
Right.
"Why do I have to yell" is saying you're responsible for my yelling, my behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And
then people say, but if they would just behave, I wouldn't feel this way.
Then I could be a perfectly wonderful mother.
Right.
Exactly. And we all would be, wouldn't we? You know, when we I don't think we realize how our desire to have children is really subconsciously and I think inherent in our species. It's more about us. It's more about keeping our immortality going rather than raising a separate person. So, and that's why we procreate. I mean, it's very much an evolutionary trait. Path. And so when we have children, we have all of these expectations of who they're going to be, what they're going to be like. And as soon as they're born, if they are biological to us, what is the conversation about right off the bat? Who does he look like? "Oh, I think he looks just like you." No, from the nose down, he's mom. From the nose up, he's dad. We immediately want to pigeonhole and identify these children as part of this family's tribe. Sameness, familiarity is essential to us and our sense of control. So as soon as we are aware that we have a child who's different, whether it's a child who's neurologically different, whether it's a child who's temperamentally different, whether it's a child who's physically different, whatever the difference, the more the difference from the parent, the more, typically, the more the resistance comes, the more desire there is to control and make that child more like what I want that child to be like. And a lot of the times we don't realize that, because consciously we're thinking, well, of course I have to take care of this child, and of course this child may have special needs, or this child may be autistic or ADHD or whatever. But the resistance that we present to the child, to their behavior, our attempts at controlling them come out of our fear.
Right.
Our fear that they're different. Our fear that we won't know what to do. We want to protect them. A lot of it comes with the intention of protection. I need to protect him so that he won't have other kids making fun of him. But that also is a protection of ourselves. I don't want to be the mother of a child who's being made fun of. And we've got to really take a look at that. It's the hard, cold facts. And the more we are focused in that direction of trying to make our children similar to us, the harder our parenting is going to be and the less accepting of our child we will be. When we can see this as a child who is nothing more than a being in our control for a limited period of time, I didn't mean in our control, in our guidance, in our care, for a limited amount of time, and not get hooked into their problems and take their behavior personally, the more we're able to accept them. Now, both tracks, whether we're on the resistant track or the acceptance track, both, when we have a child who's different from us, takes an enormous amount of time and energy, and it's exhausting. But the more accepting path can be so much easier and less exhausting, even though it takes an enormous amount of time and energy and knowledge and patience and perseverance and all of that.
I wonder if we could maybe take a look at a specific example and sort of play this out of, you know, what it looks like to
try to
first recognize our immediate impulse or reaction, to step back and say, of course they don't want to turn off the television, come do their homework. What he just said to me isn't really about me, but is a reflection of internal dysregulation of some sort, and I wonder what that might be.
Right.
And then how we can then move on from, again, what our immediate thought might be, which is, I'll show him no TV for a week, right, to punish.
I'll teach him a lesson right now.
Uh-huh. What some alternatives then might be.
Right.
And I just sort of picked that one out of the hat here, but I think most people probably have that issue, have had experienced that if their children are old enough maybe to be watching TV.
Right. So the typical reaction comes from a place of authority. I am telling you what you have to do, and you have to do it. Now, I might realize that, yeah, my kid doesn't want to turn off the TV, but as soon as I say, you have to turn off the TV, my thought is, he should do what I tell him to do, because I'm the parent.
Right.
If he doesn't turn it off, that's when we get ourselves stuck. If he doesn't listen to me, then what do I do? And so if we're coming from the position of he's being defiant, he is doing this on purpose, he is ignoring me because he doesn't want to hear what I have to say, then I'm going to go in the controlling direction. Then I am going to yell, I'm going to threaten, I'm going to punish, and when I say punish, I mean take away TV privileges, I mean take away an iPhone, take away taking him to soccer practice. These are all punishments. We think of them as consequences, and most of the use of our word consequences these days, because we don't like to use the word punishment, but most of the time we use the word consequence, we're meaning the same thing as punishment. We're still punishing. So it's coercive. Any punishment is a coercive, manipulative tactic on our part to get our children to do what we want.
Right, and through fear. So motivation through fear.
Exactly. And so if they want the TV privileges enough, if they want to go to the soccer game enough, if they want that birthday party or fight, they want their iPhone back, then they'll behave. But is that how we want to teach our children to behave so they can get what they want? That doesn't make any sense.
And some of our kids, of course, just they literally cannot control some of their impulses.
Right.
So we're completely setting them up for failure over and over again.
Exactly. And making, gross assumptions about these impulses that are dysregulated. So we think that we can try to get them to do what we want, what society wants, what is acceptable, what is not going to embarrass us out in public. And so we do what has been done to us, what we have done for ages and ages and ages. We take away a privilege. We send them to their room. We put them in timeout. We do all these things that, we ground them. And in fact, what we're doing is setting up more obstacles in that internal emotional state that are getting in their way of being successful. So that's what we've got to, that's the focus we need to have. If I can ask myself when I'm talking to my child, am I making connection or am I breaking connection? Then I know whether I'm creating obstacles. So if I know defiant, resistant behavior is coming from an obstacle inside that is telling my child, I'm not going to do what she's telling me to do because she always does, she never does what I want. She never lets me do anything. This doesn't have to be the truth. This is perception. I can't ever get what I want. Then that is an obstacle in that child's path to being successful. Now,
can I just pause just for a moment?
And
I'm sorry, I don't want to get us too off short, but when we talk about being successful, I just want to clarify whether we're talking about successful from our point of view, as in does what he's told, or successful in... Or what? I just wanted to, maybe it would be helpful to clarify that.
That's a good question, because I usually start off this by defining that word, and I didn't. Successful means regulated. Successful means I feel okay. I feel balanced in myself, and I feel balanced with my world.
Okay.
There's always a dance of kids always, the number one rule that all parents need to have of children is that all children want what they want when they want it. That is perfectly normal, normally expected behavior. That's what children are about. And so when that's, that's going to always be in there. And that's not being defiant or resistant. That's just normal. So successful means I can balance out my needs and other needs, the other needs of the people in my life. And when I can't do that because of whatever reason, then I am being, in my mind as a child, it's harder and harder and harder for me to be successful. So maybe what I should do, and then we'll get back to the television thing, is define behavior. Webster's definition of behavior is the aggregate response of internal stimuli to external stimuli. So what that means is that however that child is feeling in that innate emotional state, whether it's because they just got called a name at school or whether it's because there's this cumulative effect of not feeling accepted, not feeling feeling powerless, you know, ignored, all of that. Whatever is going on in that internal emotional state meets with what is happening in my outside world, the aggregate response of internal stimuli to external stimuli. So that external stimuli is a parent or a teacher or a sibling or a friend or a peer or an event. That comes at me and I meet it with how I am, how regulated I am, how dysregulated I am. I meet it with myself and all of my obstacles. So however I'm feeling, combined with what's coming at me, expresses in behavior. So behavior is secondary. Behavior is like the steam escaping from the boiling water. And when we only see behavior, it's as if we're taking a pot or a box and we're putting it over that steam to keep it from escaping, and we're trying to push that steam back down in the pot instead of realizing that all we have to do is turn off the heat.
Yeah, that's great. That's a really nice way to think about it. Of course, because we tend to just look, as you say, look at the behavior, make an enormous number of assumptions.
Right.
About, because we tend to take the behavior at completely at face value, very literally, whatever language comes out of their mouths.
Exactly.
They hate us. They hate
right.
whatever. They think we're stupid.
We take it personally because we identify so strongly with this child. And what parent doesn't feel hurt when their child looks at them and screams, "You're not the boss of me," or "You can't tell me what to do," or "You're not my mother"? I mean, it's just, it cuts to the core. But if you are in the practice of understanding that this behavior is telling me how my child is doing internally.
Yeah, it really is a mirror just reflecting their internal state.
Exactly. So here's the thing. When I understand that behavior is coming from this internal emotional state, and behavior is all I've got as a parent to let me know how my child is doing in that internal emotional state, and so therefore I know that if the behavior is out of control, off the wall, unacceptable, not developmentally appropriate, not temperamentally appropriate, not what I would expect of this individual child, then that means my child is a hurting puppy. That behavior tells me my child is miserable or unhappy or feeling jealous or feeling put upon or feeling unheard, whatever. So therefore, if I understand that, there is no way that I am going to punish that behavior in any way, because then I know that all I'm doing is adding insult to injury. All I'm doing is creating more obstacles for my child to hurdle, because those punishments are telling my child, "I'm not okay. I can't ever do what mom expects me to do. I can't be who dad wants me to be. I'm unacceptable. I'm bad. I'm lonely. I'm unlovable."
Now, I can hear some people sputtering, but they'll just learn that their behavior is okay then if I don't do something and let them know that what they've just said or done is wrong.
Right. And so here's the thing. When we pose the argument to punishment, we then, us parents in our parenting culture, we then assume, well, that means I've got to let my kids get away with anything they want. Then I have no control, what do I do? So it's either this coercive method of raising children, or it's totally permissive. And what we know from many, many research studies is that neither end of the spectrum raises healthy children. And so what we want to do is find that balance in the middle, and that's what my work is all about, is finding that balance, because your needs and your rights and your desires as a parent are just as important as your children's. And so what I help parents learn how to do is to problem solve. And problem solving is what takes the place of punishment. And it is, bar none, once you understand it, it's like, oh my God, of course. Bar none, the most important skill that we can teach our children to have. And it will serve them for the rest of their lives. Problem solving means we've got a problem. We've got to look at this problem. This is what I want. This is what you want. This doesn't work for me. Therefore, we have to find a way together to make this work for both of us. It's always inclusive of the child. It is never the parent dictating how things have to be. Now, disclaimer, that doesn't mean that there aren't plenty of times when we have to tell our children what to do. You know, don't run out in the road. Don't speak to whatever. We're always, you know, teaching our children what they can and cannot do. But when it comes to problem behavior, when it comes to a conflict, when that child is refusing to turn off the television and go to bed, that's the time for problem solving. And even parents who I teach problem solving to, and I talk about it and talk about it, they'll still come back and say, yeah, but what do I do in the moment? And it's like we can't get it that we're doing anything if we're not punishing or threatening or coercing or bribing. We don't get that we're doing anything.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It makes us feel really helpless and out of control, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's a really uncomfortable place.
To think that we're letting them get away with it?
Yeah.
But you see, if I understand that this child wants to do the right thing, he just doesn't want to go to bed. Of course he doesn't want to go to bed. So therefore, any blame or my assumptions switch to this place of course he doesn't want to go to bed. He just wants to watch television. That's what he would do all night long if I weren't restricting his time. There's nothing, that doesn't mean he's a bad person. He just wants to do that. It's my job as a parent to make sure he gets to bed. So therefore, I am not looking at that as he's got to learn to turn that television off and do what I say. Especially young children don't have those kinds of self-structure. They haven't put their own structure on their lives yet. That's why they're in our care. We're the ones who need to do that. So therefore, I'm the one who has to get the television off and get him to bed. But I can do it in a lot of different ways. So if I approach him with the understanding that, of course, he wants to watch television and he's not being bad because he wants to, then I will come at it with a very calm approach. And maybe I'll start off by saying, it's time for bed. Do you want to turn off the television or shall I?
No, I'm not turning it off. You can't make me.
Right. Then I'm going to go, whoa, you really, really don't want that television off.
No, you never let me watch anything, and Jimmy gets to stay up till 11. Everybody in my class stays up as long as they want.
So then my job as a connective parent is to hear what he's saying. What is he saying? It's unfair, right? He
right,
is
I never
saying,
get to do what I want.
Not
you're
fair,
treating me differently.
Exactly. So then I respond with, wow, that feels really unfair to you then, doesn't it? You just think, I never let you do what you want. That's got to feel really awful. Period.
And
no but.
Yeah.
Period. Because if you're truly acknowledging and empathizing with your child, that's where you stop, right there. You don't bring in your butts. You just acknowledge, I hadn't realized how unfair that feels to you.
And that, I will say, that kind of just takes the wind right out of the sails, doesn't it?
Oh, boy, it sure does.
I mean, because then there's nothing to fight back against.
That's right.
I mean, then you're more likely to get maybe a kid who then starts to cry and says, you're right, it's not fair, and then you've got something that you can comfort.
Then you might get a story of how left out he is at school and how he just wants to watch this program so he can talk about it at school. Or maybe it has nothing to do with program or television. It's just his frustration, his resistance to you is the symbol, the symptom of something much deeper that's going on. When you connect with a child this way, you learn so much more about them that you would never learn, because he's never going to say that if I'm going to say, don't you talk back to me, you are getting into bed right now or there's no TV for the rest of the week. Then I am never going to hear what's going on with this child. And he is learning that I will never listen. How many of all of you listening felt that you could always tell your side of the story with your parents? How many of you think that your parents always took your agenda, your side of the story, your desires into consideration? That they listened to you, that they really listened? And isn't that what we all want? And now I know that everybody out there is thinking, so then what? So then what do you do?
Right. So I let him stay up another hour.
Yeah. Right.
So I say, you know what, buddy, I know you feel really sad. Let's go talk about it upstairs. And then, you know, and some of our kids, of course, I'm saying our sort of globally, right? They really would resist turning the TV off. I mean, they might throw the remote control at you. They might run at you and attack you. I mean, you know, there's some
right.
aggressive behaviors out there, too, that I know a lot of families are struggling with. Or maybe they come over and they whomp their sister or something in the head. Because the thought of turning the TV off is just more than they can even,
right.
you know.
So when you know that's the case, then you want to make sure that TV is not on up until the minute it's time to go to bed, because you're going to have a battle over it. So, you know, it's not a good idea to have TV on in the evening. It's not, I mean, now we're getting very specific to TV.
Sure.
But, you know, that sort of thing. You want to have things like that that you know your child is going to have a really difficult time leaving because of the transition, because of the end, because of what that means to this child. You want to take that into consideration of your structure of the day. So then the other piece of this is that the other side of coming at this behavior with control and punishment and threats is, okay, honey, you can do, you can just stay. The parent, and this is what we see a lot of today, the parent who does not stand up for him or herself, who does not put her needs on the same par as her child's needs. The parent who will give and give and give and give. And then, unfortunately, the result of that is the parent who expects appreciation for what I've given this child, or gets thoroughly resentful when this child then keeps taking and taking and taking.
Which is really what they've been trained to do.
That's exactly. That's what giving and giving trains them to do. So
this is complicated.
It is the most, the hardest job in the world. It's a constant balancing act. And you can't come up with an ABC of how to parent because of the variety of children we have. You know, I have one of each. I have a son who was my firstborn, an absolute piece of cake kid. He just kind of went along with everything. He was just happy-go-lucky kid. Stuff rolled off his back. He didn't get really upset. You know, he had a handful of temper tantrums when he was 2 and 3. But for the most part, he was just this happy kid. And so, therefore, of course, I felt like a great parent.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand why people were having these problems. And then, 4.5 years later, I had my daughter, who was cut from a different mold. And she's the one I call my teacher, because I could never do this work had I not had her. And she brought me to my knees and humbled me, and I had to throw everything, not throw it out the window, but I had to completely come up with a total different set of expectations for her and a total different way of understanding her. And I had to put in a lot of work and learn who she was and what she needed. And that's our job as parents. We've got to learn about who our kids are, because every single one of them has a different blueprint. And so, therefore, the expectations we have for them need to be quite different. But I don't want to leave the audience hanging on, oh, that feels so unfair. Now what do I do? That is the connection moment. When you acknowledge what's going on for your child and you interpret, important word here, interpret their behavior. Interpret the words they're saying. I call this childology. So that I hear the words or I see the behavior, but I immediately, and this takes practice and patience, understand what that's trying to tell me. So I'm always asking, what is this behavior trying to tell me? So therefore, I hear that it feels very unfair. Whether it is or not, in my estimation, doesn't matter. What I'm doing right now is connecting with my child's emotions. And so I'm acknowledging that. And as you said, Allison, it kind of takes the wind out of their sails, and it's like sometimes there are tears, sometimes there's more anger and pushing and resistance. So can I? Yes, it's unfair. You've got to let me watch this. Perhaps this leads to a negotiation so that once a week this program gets taped or recorded and watched at a different day if it's really important for him to share this with his friends at school so he feels more accepted at school. If I see it that way, if I have the information that leads me to that, And the other part is he just wants to stay up late. Of course he does. And so therefore you come at it with, this doesn't work for me. I can't let you do this. Of course you want to stay up. I'm your parent. I'm the one who has to ensure that you get enough sleep. And then we allow our children to have the anger and the frustration and all of the feelings that go along with it, the disappointment when they can't get what they want. This is all important for kids to go through.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the other part that people get scared of a lot.
Right.
Because we get scared of other people's emotions and we get scared of our own emotions.
Right. And so we don't want to go there, and so we tend to fix it. And then if we fix it, we let him stay up another half hour or whatever, then we get resentful and angry and feeling out of control. And then we snap.
And then they're cranky the next day because they can't get enough sleep, and the whole thing is a downward spiral.
Exactly. And it's just,
yeah.
Just like, so we need to be very clear about it. And if we acknowledge their side of it, then our children are left with, oh, I still have to go to bed, but Mom understands, Dad understands that this feels unfair to me or whatever. So that's what happens. It's not a great illustration for problem solving, but problem solving means being able to say, this doesn't work for me or this doesn't work for you, and we need to figure this out so that we both get what we want here. So the goal of problem solving is nobody loses, nobody gets in trouble, because children get very defensive when they think they're going to get in trouble. So they're very protective. So that's whenever getting in trouble means any form of punishment or yelling or threatening or whatever.
And for a lot of these kids, it can be even just that your tone of voice changes, and they can see that you're getting upset with them. And that's a punishment to a lot of them as well.
Right, right. You just use a firm voice, and they say, you're yelling at me.
Yeah, or it signals that you've withdrawn your love forever.
Right.
So, I mean, this really can be so tricky. And I assume then I imagine you also try to help parents understand that, you know, they're not going to be superstar problem solvers right away. They're
right.
going to make a lot of mistakes.
Right, right.
And you can't beat yourself up about that either.
Boy, do I have a minute to tell my most favorite story?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
This is problem solving for a 2-year-old. When parents think, I can't do this, my kids are too young. This was about a 2- and 3-quarter-year-old. This happened in the first parenting group I ever taught. And we were talking about problems, and we were talking about depersonalizing the problem. So we're taking the blame out of it. And so this mother came in the following week after we'd been talking about this and said, well, I've got a story. Her not yet 3-year-old was sitting at the kitchen counter with his lunch or something, and he spilled his milk. And she said, he didn't just accidentally knock it over. He spilled his milk. It was clearly an intentional thing. And she said to him, you have to clean that up. And he looked at her and he said, no. And she started getting livid, and she said, you spilled it, you clean it up. And he looked at her with that sly look, and he said, no, you do it, right? Enough to push any mother's button to its max. And for some reason, the class dropped into her head, and she did it. And she lowered her blood pressure and crossed her arms. I think she was also thinking, well, wait till I tell Bonnie this and show her how this doesn't work.
Right, right, I'm sure.
Right. She said, okay, the milk is spilled. I don't want to clean it up, and you don't want to clean it up. What do you think we should do about it? Expecting nothing, right? And he just brightened right up. His face lit up. He said, I know. I'll go call Sophie, their dog, and she'll come in and lick it up, and then I'll clean up the rest with a paper towel.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
So her jaw just dropped to the floor, and all she could come out with was, okay. He happily ran to the door, called in the dog. The dog happily licked up the milk. He went to get the paper towels, and he, not terribly efficiently, wiped up the rest of the dog's slobber. And there is problem solved with a two-year-old. You know, he learned how to take care of that problem. And he did it because he wasn't blamed. She took away the blame. She took away the criticism. She just said, okay, here's the problem. How are we going to solve this? So problem solving, obviously, can get very, very complex. And you don't always come up with an answer that's satisfactory to